Evident Footprint Show, where we talk about government, music, art, health, science, ufology, religion, metaphysics, and all things spiritual. In short, we'll examine the truth, and when we find things that aren't right, we'll offer creative solutions. And now, the host of Evident Footprints, Don Nikoloff.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Evident Footprints on this September the 10th on the West Coast, now the 7th anniversary of 9/11 on the East Coast. My name is Don Nikoloff, and I'll be with you for the next hour. I apologize on behalf of the network for the delay, technical issues with computers. Maybe they'll get a Mac. I've been urging them to get a Mac. Macs don't do this. Anyway, welcome to the show. We have a surprise this evening. Normally, tonight's guest is on Friday nights. He's our science advisor, and he is a scientist, an inventor, author, lecturer, teacher, and a good friend. He's becoming a comedian week by week. And with that, I'm not going to delay the show any further. I'd like to welcome to Evident Footprints again, Mr. Jim Murray. Jim, good evening.
Hey, Don, how are you tonight?
I'm fine. I should say good morning now, right? It's morning. Anyway, I'm okay.
Good.
Last week, we had a two-hour show, actually last Friday, and we discussed the various types of water. Before we go into this, I want to acknowledge an email I got from Bill in Bellingham, Washington. He was wondering what our thoughts were about the recent test of the Atom Smasher, the one in Geneva, Switzerland. And, you know, they did a test, and they had a small blip on a screen, and they deemed it a success. And they're trying to replicate the Big Bang, which to me sounds like total insanity. I don't know. Evidently, this is going to lead to how the universe was created. We can't solve the problems here down on this planet, and they're trying to play God. That's my opinion. I don't know what else to say. Any thoughts on that?
Well, you just opened up a huge can of worms as far as I'm concerned. First of all, I have to be honest with you. When I was a younger man, I had an absolute passion for designing particle accelerators and atom smashers, call them what you will. And I came to the conclusion that what I was really in love with was the design and operation of the machinery, not so much that I had faith in the concept, because quite frankly, it's like hurling a china set against the wall and then examining the fragments to determine who made the dishes. It doesn't really lead to anything. I
and
presume
who made the
that
wall?
The,
I was going to
yeah,
say,
exactly.
And who made the wall, too?
I think
ahead.
That probably what he's referring to are the... I haven't been keeping up with it either, so you'll forgive my ignorance, but I think just from what I have heard, he might be referring to the new collider experiments where they're hurling subatomic particles, rather massive ones too, like even up to helium nuclei, at each other at ungodly velocities, and then when they do collide, all sorts of things are happening, and they're trying to make sense out of it. If it leads them to an understanding of the Big Bang, I'm very happy for them because I don't believe in it. But
I don't either, yeah.
But anyway, I haven't been away from that kind of stuff for quite some time. The only thing I do know is that the amount of money that it takes to build those machines is astronomical. Just astronomical. Some of them are like several miles in diameter now.
Yeah, they say this one is 17, it's a 17-mile tunnel. Of course, it's circular. They're calling it, in the article, he actually sent, Bill sent us an article from mynorthwest.com. It's an Associated Press article, And these guys are drinking champagne and celebrating, watching it on satellite around the world. And they're referring to it not so much as the super collider as an atom smasher. Just giving you the slant of the article, they describe having spent $10 billion. I doubt if it's only $10 billion. And they're basically running these atoms in contrary motion to each other, fired at near the speed of light, it says, in opposite directions through a tube about the size of a fire hose. Somehow, I don't know how you equate this with God. I can't imagine. Now, it seems like they're trying to play God to me, but there's, you know, because the Earth hasn't blown up, I guess they consider this a success. Now, wait till they ramp this thing up at full power and imagine what's going to happen. I don't know enough about it, but to me, you know, the gut feeling is that they're playing with fire here.
Well, the real thing is that I don't think they're going to learn what they think they're going to learn. You know, the whole concept of a so-called atom smasher originally was to do exactly that. It was to accelerate subatomic particles, whether they be electrons, protons, or some form of heavy ions, as atomic bullets, you might say, and use them to collide with various nuclei and predetermined targets, such that they could then make a prediction about the result and hopefully learn how the basic building blocks of matter interact with one another and what kind of reactions you could anticipate. Like, for instance, when a uranium-238 atom accepts into its nucleus an additional neutron, it goes through this whole transfiguration. It becomes neptunium-239, I think it is, and then that decays by emitting another particle, and it winds up being plutonium, which is a very fissionable material. And so, you know, they observed reactions of this sort occurring in nature, and they said, well, what if we supply the particles, you know, for this type of stuff? Then what happens? And, of course, they learned very quickly that it takes a certain amount of initial energy associated with the particle in order to penetrate these various nuclei and do various transmutational changes. And so they begin building machines more and more powerful, and then they started looking at the possibility of, well, what happens if two protons collide with each other? What do you learn? And so, you know, a proton, for instance, has always been accepted as a basic building block of nature, like an electron and a neutron. And so the assumption was, well, if it's a basic building block, it's not made up of anything else, then we ought to learn something interesting. Well, then it turns out that there's a whole shower of even smaller particles that comes out of that. And so they came up with mu mesons and pi mesons and neutrinos and quarks and charms and all kinds of other nonsense. And now they look for the laws that are saying, well, okay, if you have so much energy on hand and two particles of the same mass collide, you know, why do you get this particular configuration of shower of particles? And they apply the laws of quantum physics to it, and it says that, you know, energy is going to group together in packets, you know, based on the quantum physical laws, and so you won't get an infinite number of particles, you'll get a discrete number of particles. And somehow it all adds up to what you had before the explosion or the infection or whatever. But I personally lost interest in that game because I couldn't see where it leads to. Now what they're doing is taking an entire host of particles and accelerating them towards another huge group of particles and allowing them to collide at velocities near the speed of light, and you get all sorts of interesting results. Well, you know what? It pays salaries and it keeps people busy. I honestly don't think that it will, you know, cause some major disruption in the world as we know it. But the real question is, how valuable is the investigation?
Mm-hmm.
I personally don't believe in the Big Bang Theory. Even if it happened, it doesn't explain anything. Because the next logical question is, okay, so something blew up. Well, where did that come from? And now you got a new theory to explain how the Big Bang occurred. You know, it's just, that kind of circular logic never gets you anywhere. And the strange thing is, I'm always perplexed by the fact that these people put endless amounts of energy into explaining all this garbage, and nobody ever asks the question, well, where did the thing come from in the first place that blew up? You know, I'm familiar with the fact that they have the concept of entropy death in the universe, and how the Big Bang set everything in motion, and very slowly, as we approach entropy, everything is coming to a halt, and then sooner or later it'll all reverse and come back together again and recompress into another singularity, and then there'll be another big explosion, and we'll have a whole new universe. But even if that's all true, it didn't explain anything. Because it's only, what you would call a sub assembly of the real mechanism.
Mm-hmm. And in a different environment too. I mean, it's subject to the laws of physics in the three-dimensional world. I mean, it's insanity to me. Well, if I could interrupt just for a second and read one little paragraph here, and then share my thought about this. The CERN experiments, this is a quote from the article, the CERN experiments could reveal more about dark matter, antimatter, and possibly hidden dimensions of space and time. It could also find evidence of a hypothetical particle, the Higgs boson, which is sometimes called the God particle because it is believed to give mass to all other particles and thus to matter that makes up the universe. Now, to me, they're trying to play God. But listen to the terminology, dark matter, as if we don't have enough dark matter down here already. Antimatter, which is an obsession with these people, and possibly hidden dimensions of space and time. As secret as they are right now, they've got to find more places to hide their gold and their corruption, it seems to me. And it would be, now, my comment about this, if I can rant for a moment here, is why don't they take that $10 billion and figure out how to grow edible food and how to clean up the water? Just as an example, maybe try to do away with pharmaceutical drugs that are poisoning people all over the planet. Get rid of disease. How much would that cost? Do you think they could do that for $10 billion? Oh, my God.
Well, even if they couldn't do it, Don, it would be a step in a positive direction. Mm-hmm. I think it's an absolute statement of arrogance to assume that if you build the right machine, the right piece of machinery, you're going to have some kind of revelation about how the universe really works and how it came into existence. I've long ago accepted the fact that my puny little mind is never going to know the answers to those things. And I honestly believe that even if God himself came down here and tutored me personally, I still wouldn't get it because I don't have the capacity to get it. Neither does anyone else. So I think the real chore here...
Go ahead.
Pardon?
I was just saying, except for the Illuminati, they're the ones that understand this stuff.
Well, maybe that's why they're so high and lofty, you know.
Yeah.
But I can't aspire to those heights. And so I'm going to just accept my limitations and direct my God-given energies and intelligence towards understanding things that make sense, that have a practical outcome, and will do some good for the rest of humanity.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think that that's the right approach, not because it's my idea, but because common sense tells you that no matter how much money you spend, you will never understand this universe. Never.
Yeah. Well, you know, Jim, the listeners out there, or maybe a few of the listeners, may think that I have sort of a primitive, closed-minded attitude about technology and advancing our technological capacity to understand these things. I'm not against that, but take care of business first before you just waste this money. And the article describes the amount of fear that was present, not knowing what's going to happen. Okay, so they got a blip on a screen. They do that every day in the banking industry. They get blips as they shuffle trillions of dollars around while people are starving. And that, to me, is the important issue. The degradation of the quality of life here. Seems that we've got our priorities all inside out and backwards and upside down at the same time. And I'm sure you would agree.
Oh, I definitely agree. As a matter of fact, you know, we touch on this almost every week. I definitely agree with that. But, you know, as you pointed out, none of it makes any sense to begin with. If the same people that control all this money are also some of the ones that initiate programs for the dumbing down of the populace, the production of non-nutritive foods, the pollution of water, the degradation of our atmosphere, which we breathe, by the way, and all these other horrible things that are going on, what the heck is the point of building this stupid machine, which probably won't tell you anything anyway? It's like it doesn't make any sense. The only thing that I can figure is that it helps to perpetuate the illusion that the people that control all this stuff have this great fountain of knowledge at their disposal. And it's a humbling effect to the poor peons that are shuffling around trying to make a living in a very meager way. You know, it gives them something to write about in the newspapers, some article for a person to read and oogle over. But I really don't think any hard knowledge is going to come from that direction.
Yeah, I'm inclined to agree with you. Well, Bill, I think we answered your question. Of course, this is just the opinion of two individuals. Now, if you were to ask any of these people involved in the project, I'm sure you'd get the other side of the coin. That doesn't mean that they're right or we're right or we're wrong. It's just our opinions, right, Jim?
Yeah, it's just an opinion, you know, and as I admitted, I've been away from it for 20-some-odd years, and a lot of stuff has happened, I'm sure. So I could even be labeled as misinformed at this point, but common sense, I hope, still reigns, and I just don't see how all this leads to anything positive. Especially when you compare it to the everyday problems that you brought out, you know, Don?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Well, we were going to talk about water tonight, or we are going to talk about water. And since I lost my ability to play my my commercial this evening, we're going to have to talk straight through. So if you want to pick up where we left off last week, I know you had covered quite a bit about the different types of water and even how Tesla found a use for water, a very practical use that we're still using today. And, you know, jump into the topic wherever you feel comfortable.
Well, actually, where we left off last week had to do with the spiritual qualities of water. And we had talked about the fact that its crystal structure is actually capable of so many intricate patterns, just like snowflakes in the solid state, that it turns out that information of various types can literally affect the water molecules or the water crystals and wind up using the water's structure as a carrier for this information. And the interesting thing is there's been a lot of research done on that lately, especially in Japan. I don't remember the name of the gentleman who was responsible for that kind of research, but the various types of waters and the various types of effects that the energies have and the information has on their shapes and on their effects on people who drink the water and things of that nature has definitely been looked into in great detail, and he has published a lot of information on this. I think his name is Dr. Emoto, if I remember correctly.
That's correct.
Yeah, so there's a lot of interesting stuff going on, and interestingly enough, I think where we actually concluded was with the idea that blessing water or blessing food before you eat it, which affects the water, then actually affects its absorption and the quality of the nutrients it delivers and things of that nature. And those are very radical thoughts, but they've been proven to be true. And quite honestly, I would like to see $27 billion or whatever it was be spent on this kind of stuff rather than on, you know, a super collider in Europe.
Yeah, well, they claim it was $10 billion, but you and I both know it was a lot more than that, I'm sure. That there would probably be riots if we knew how much they spent on it. You know?
I wouldn't doubt it. But anyway, the thing that's interesting here is that there have been some really, really cool people that have investigated various aspects of water. Mm-hmm. And I would like to touch on some of those guys tonight and then from there go on into the other areas that you and I discussed, which we didn't have a chance to explore last week.
Okay.
The one guy in particular who I really admire is Victor Schoberger. And, of course, he's deceased now. I forget what year he died, but I think it was back in the 50s. And he had started his career as a forest ranger, or the German equivalent of a forest ranger, in that country. Actually, it was in Austria, I believe. And he had noticed some fantastic things about water, which he saw firsthand just because of the fact that his duties put him in that environment on a regular basis. But he was amazed because the things that he was seeing were not ever expounded upon in any course that he knew about. It wasn't taught in the subject of hydraulics or aquadynamics or any of those subjects. And so he just started into it on his own, and it led him into some extraordinary things. Well, where this actually started, Don, was with salmon and other fish that swim upstream to spawn. And he used to sit on the banks in these streams and watch what the fish do. And one of the things that he noticed was that a fish has the ability to stay almost absolutely stationary in a very rapidly flowing stream without exerting any effort, or at least very, very little effort. Certainly, the thing that struck him was the fact that the effort was in nowhere proportional to the result obtained. And so he began to wonder about how the heck can that happen. And then another thing that he found out, which is pretty extraordinary also, is that we see pictures of salmon leaping up waterfalls. And we're so used to seeing it that I don't think we think about it. And what he discovered after a lot of testing and a lot of investigating is that they literally levitate up the waterfalls. They don't jump. He did tests and found out that they can't have the muscle power to lift their own weight in any way that would allow them to jump up the waterfall. But they actually fall up the waterfall by making use of a levitation principle. And so he got involved with studying that phenomenon and found out that it had to do with the diamagnetic moment of water, and that water has all these incredible properties that that only he became an expert on. And one of the things that he based a lot of his conclusions on is the fact that the magnetic aspects of water allow it to do these things by virtue of the fact that it makes use of the implosion principle rather than the explosion principle. And he likened this to the fact that there are two basic fundamental principles that manifest throughout the universe. And the one that we're familiar with in most of our technological pursuits is the wheel. And the thing that's interesting about the wheel is that the tangential velocity on the outside of the wheel is very high. But as you approach the center of the wheel, the tangential velocity gets smaller and smaller and smaller until finally, at the very center of the wheel, you have like a singularity. You have a point at which supposedly there's no motion at all. And so a lot of the aspects of physics that we deal with on a daily basis have to do with the geometry of the wheel and the consequences of rotating mass with that type of construction. Now, the interesting thing is water and other forms of energy actually behave as the inverse of the wheel, where the rim of the wheel is at high-speed rotation and its center is stationary. If you examine a vortex, for instance, the rim of the vortex is stationary, and the center of the vortex is where there's the most activity. And so it's literally the opposite. Now, when I was doing some of my, actually, it isn't the opposite, it's the inverse. When I was doing some of my earlier investigations, what I did, I programmed the graphics computer to take the equations for a circle and literally plot the results after first dividing the equation into one, which is another way of creating an inverse function. Then what you get is two wormholes. You get two vortexes connected together, or two funnels, or whatever you want to call it, that are connected together. And it's just amazing that they have, that you can get this geometry by inverting the circle. Mm-hmm. But his experiments with all this stuff led to the development of an implosion engine. It led to the development of a craft, which was then grabbed by the German government and later became known as the Foo Fighter, which was some sort of a paragravitic or anti-gravity device, and all various types of free energy, including cold electricity, which is a fantastic development, and all of that was related back to his studies of water. So, you know, it's an amazing thing. Here you have a guy who spent his whole lifetime looking into these incredible things. He achieved great things during his lifetime. All of that stuff, if it wasn't destroyed, was certainly suppressed. And the average folks out there don't know anything about this, and yet people are convinced that everything that can be done has already been done, and there's nothing interesting to investigate.
Mm-hmm.
And that is just a real thorn in my side, you know.
Now, when you, Jim, if I may interrupt for a second, when you mentioned the salmon sort of just suspended in midstream in this heavy current, what came to mind was that salmon knew how to find a vortex in the water or position itself, that the water acted like a vortex. And actually, Schauberger actually was involved in a lot of vortexian research. And the Germans, the Nazis in particular, had him developing a model craft, a flying saucer, back in 1940. And it was called the Repulsion Type A. I don't know if you were familiar with that.
Yes, I am very familiar with it. And the interesting thing about it is after the war, certain wealthy individuals in Texas invited him to come over to this country with his son and continue the research. And from what I understand, he actually accepted that challenge, came over here, and was basically milked of most of his information, and then sent back to Austria brokenhearted, and he basically died shortly after that.
Yeah.
So all that knowledge went somewhere, and we've talked about the fact that the rockets possessed by NASA are probably nowhere near the technology that's actually available, and we've talked about the fact that there are settlements on Mars, some of which may be extraterrestrial, some of which may be Earth type. Establishments, and very possibly another form of craft was used to ferry all these individuals and equipment from Earth to that location.
Mm-hmm.
It's not impossible to imagine that that's what happened to some of the Schauberger stuff, just like they stole all the Tesla stuff.
Mm-hmm. Or they could have actually given the notebooks and the research that Tesla did to Schauberger to get him, let's say, give him a start, knowing that he had an innate understanding of these principles. I'm looking at a drawing of this craft, and I noticed that the primary hull is made of copper. The rim is sort of a foil. It has a high-speed motor, a vortex turbine. So he was along that same line as some of the work that Tesla was doing. I'm certain of that. It's just the feeling I have. I mean, I don't have proof, but Tesla was pretty fed up with what was going on at that time in his life, and he only had two more years to live anyway. So. In terms of these inventions now, what were his contributions to water beyond these channels and things like that he developed? Are you familiar with any particular?
I'm familiar with some of them. Like, for instance, he investigated the phenomenon called Tugger, which is the force that causes water to rise up in plants.
Mm-hmm.
And he also investigated the fact that there's a relationship between the height of the water table, the mountain terrain, and the tree line, and the local magnetic forces on Earth.
Mm-hmm.
And determines, like, for instance, how far up a mountain slope the trees will grow before they reach the so-called tree line. I mean, the common theory is that it has to do with just the altitude.
Mm-hmm.
But he proceeded to demonstrate that what it actually has to do with is this incredible ability the water has to literally levitate itself. And he produced in his laboratory a very striking demonstration of this, where he built a large mountain on top of a tub, And the mountain essentially represented, I mean, it was a big plaster thing, but it represented a mountain that existed over a some type of underground aquifer. Mm-hmm. And by using nothing more than some type of insulation, and he was never, to my knowledge at least, he was never very explicit about what that meant. Except that I'm under the impression, after having read the work, that it was some type of rock strata or marble or some kind of igneous metamorphic rock. And with the proper application of that, what happens is the water literally rises up a channel that he produced inside this mountain, this artificial mountain, erupts at the top, and then just flows back down the side and falls back into the tub. And he demonstrated, at least to my satisfaction, that there was an electromagnetic phenomenon associated with the lifting of water from the subterranean vaults where it accumulates, you know, to these heights, which are well above the water table.
Mm-hmm.
And then it flows by means of gravity back down to the, you know, to the lower levels where it seeps back into the earth and returns to its origin. But right there, if that's true, is a demonstration of a phenomenon which is certainly unknown, and it's associated with something as elemental as water, and it could change our understanding of things in an enormous way. If we weren't busy spending the $27 billion on super colliders.
Well, it implies that there's more water than we're led to believe, number one, for drinking purposes or, what you know, for man's use. And I'm not talking about polluting, but if that water is able to do that, I would suspect that it's probably immune from the system. Maybe the intelligence of the water is it goes underground just to get away from the pollution and the politicians.
Don't get me started in that direction tonight. I'm feeling a little bit too aggressive, Don. I might might say something I regret.
Well, what is interesting to me, okay, you mentioned the spirituality of water, and obviously if water is able to operate on a metaphysical level, and humans and animals and plants and really all life is operating under these same metaphysical principles, then it would seem like it would behoove us to be focusing on that in terms of our reality, understanding it and employing it, using it to our benefit. Now, those that control the planet have other means in mind, and so that knowledge, if it's known, would be kept from us. It seems that we, on our own, could come to some understanding, because water is life. Water is healing. Water is essential to support life. I'm not telling you anything you don't know. This is basically just a fundamental universal principle. Wherever there is water, there is life. And the applications that would be there, if we just researched water, I think we would come to many understandings about our longevity and our health and our intelligence and our consciousness. Water seems to be able to hold that consciousness, and it doesn't need a stupid man to figure out how to do its thing. It's got all the information it needs to survive and to transform itself or transmute itself from one state to another, yet man seemed to dishonor that.
Well, it's like anything else. I mean, yeah, you know, he dishonors it, but does he do that in the same way that you dishonor something with intent, or is this really a reflection of his ignorance? You know, it's the same old story.
Well, I think it's both, actually. If we just use tap water as an example, you know, following along the line of Schauberger, he developed many systems for transporting, or, you know, the whole concept of creating tap water. Whose idea was it to put fluoride in it, you know?
Oh, well, that certainly had nothing to do with him.
Well, yeah, but that's what I mean. It's this idea that somehow this is not going to affect the water and the rest of the world in its natural state as we recycle this stuff back into, you know, into nature. You know, I mean, it's beyond ignorance. The intent is there as well. That's the point I was making. You were going to say?
I don't remember now.
Before I interrupted your thought.
But it doesn't matter. I know what I was leading up to, even if I forgot my immediate thoughts. What he attributed a lot of this incredible ability of water to was the fact that it had a certain charge, and he referred to it as a diamagnetic charge. Now, I have to be honest with you. I did my best to uncover in textbooks and other places a definition for this diamagnetic charge, and I was never really successful at it. But assuming that was just his choice of words and that there is some kind of a charge associated with water while it's underground, which could be, by the way, simply because of the fact that it's, you know, the Earth is a charged sphere, and if water is residing below the surface, then it's actually inside of a charge-free region. And so it could have certain qualities in that respect that we haven't noticed, and maybe it's because we always study water on the surface. You know, maybe there's something unique about primary water that we don't know yet. But anyway, the point that I wanted to make was that if you go in and find yourself a stream that's actually coming out of the ground, actually bubbling up out of the ground, and you're fortunate enough to be at its source, it's a really interesting phenomenon to view. And there's this very peculiar wave, if you want to call it that, that actually looks like it's pulsating. It comes up, and then it kind of opens like a flower, and it spills down in every direction, and then it drops back down again. It's almost like a little miniature geyser kind of action. Mm-hmm. And his explanation of this was the fact that water isn't being pushed to the surface by subterranean pressures. It's actually levitating itself towards its opposite charge in the atmosphere. And
that's
then
the
when it actually...
chart. Yeah.
Exactly, and then when it actually frees itself from the surrounding rock strata or the ground, then it's suddenly exposed to the air. It picks up the neutralizing charge, and so therefore that water loses its ability to levitate, and it falls down on top of the other water, which is still coming up, and it causes this little miniature oscillation, and then it slides to the side. And the next quantity of water beneath it repeats the same cycle. And I've actually seen this happen, but of course, I don't have any, you know, I don't have any instruments or anything to go to some remote site and see if you can learn anything. Mm-hmm. But what amazes me is the fact that that Schauberger had the not only the insight to recognize the existence of this particular phenomenon, but was acute enough to identify what the mechanism actually consisted of and then reproduce it in a laboratory, because all these early experiments were the basis of which he later developed these ultra technologies that the Nazis stole. Another amazing thing that he did, and you probably know about this, was the redesigning of the log flumes in the logging industry in that part of the country, they were having all kinds of problems with log jams and all types of difficulties and some logs sinking and other logs floating, and nobody understood any of this, and they spent more time dynamiting log jams and pulling the logs apart and what have you to keep the traffic of lumber moving downstream. And he came along and actually designed a log flume that was all wood in its construction and based on his particular understanding of hydraulics. And these logs would shoot down through these things like they had no friction whatsoever. And literally the flow was faster than that of the river beneath the construction. And from what I understand, that apparatus was in use for many years before it fell apart or was taken down or whatever. So he learned a lot about the natural movement of water and the paths that it preferred and all this type of stuff. And by the way, he was absolutely against the concept, which we seem to be so determined to utilize, of straightening out rivers and waterways so that they run straight and true. And he said that it might look like it's a more efficient system, but actually it isn't. And not only that, but it kills the life energy in the water. He said the reason why the water undulates as it goes down the waterways and the various courses that nature provides for it is because of the fact that it's literally reacting to these diamagnetic forces in conjunction with the powers that are emanating from the planet itself, and it steers itself, and it knows where it wants to go, and it is finding the most realistic and efficient path. And when you short-circuit this entire effect by straightening it out because you think that it'll flow better, not only does it not flow better, but it always causes a total loss of vegetation along the banks of the water as the vortexian motion is eliminated. It reduces the life force available on both sides of the stream.
Well, so, what you're describing right there, Jim, reminds me of what I know about water and its capacity to heal the human body. If you consider our DNA strands or spirals, it would match that, wouldn't it, in its natural state?
Oh, I'm definitely sure that there's a functional relationship between all these things, Don. You know, the universe has a tendency to use basic principles over and over again in higher octaves of expression so that you always wind up somehow using related principles, but their manifestations become more and more complex. And incidentally, that's one of the it's one of the secrets of human evolution, in my opinion, is first of all noticing these trends, and then secondly actually studying them so you have an in-depth understanding, and then moving on to the higher and higher facets of this type of information, it leads you to higher and higher expressions of this knowledge, until finally you're at the vestibule of the spirit world, or the spiritual world.
Yeah. Now, we know that water is a conductor. I mean, it's obvious that you wouldn't want to be in a swimming pool and have someone put a live electrical wire into the water. It'll result in electrocution. So water transmits electricity. It transmits sound. As we know, we can hear sound underwater. That's how whales and dolphins and porpoises communicate, and probably a lot of other creatures that we can't hear because of the frequency or the nature of the sound waves that they emanate. But we know that Now, on the basis of what you're talking about, this diamagnetic force, water then also has the intelligence to respond to magnetic energy. And in this case, you're talking about an inversion of 180 degrees as it's coming out of the ground. What if we were to apply that to that system, that method, to how we transport water or how we use water? Couldn't we somehow apply that technology to purify water, to reverse all of this pollution? Because what you're describing, to me, that's how water responds, and you put all these substances in there, and it has to interfere with water's ability to do what it does naturally.
Yeah, actually, that's a fascinating series of insights, because it brings us to the next guy I wanted to talk about, which is our old friend Professor Brown, and his research into Brown's gas, which, of course, is nothing more than another form of water. Uh-huh. And the reason that I wanted to touch on that is because, first of all, his initial intention was to find a way to use water as fuel, and we had talked about that on some of the other shows that we did. Uh-huh. But I don't think we talked about some of his other innovations. One of which was using Brown's gas as a means for actually transporting water, which you touched on, you know, probably intuitively just a minute ago. And also the other thing that's pretty interesting is the utilization of Brown's gas for the purpose of purifying water. And I'd like to touch on those two for a moment, if I may.
Okay. Well, see, I am psychic, so I'm seeing your outline that I don't have a copy of. I'm just joking. Go ahead.
Well, I know you're my sidekick. Get it?
I'm a sidekick, yes. I give sidekick readings.
On the subject of using the Brown's gas itself as a means of transporting water, he had come up with some pretty amazing ideas. One of them was a pump that literally worked by means of the implosion mechanism associated with the water and with the Brown's gas. And, of course, you know, like any other pump, it makes use of the atmospheric the weight of the atmosphere to actually do the work on the water. But what was different in his case was the fact that the resulting vacuum, which moved the water, did so without the presence of any piston. You know, it was a device that literally made use of a chamber in which a pressure was built up with the Brown's gas. And then when the Brown's gas was ignited, the resulting implosion suddenly caused a vacuum into which the water was pushed by the atmospheric pressure. And actually, that's a pretty snazzy arrangement when you stop to think of it, especially if you have a design that allows you to do it repetitively. And he talked about using this mechanism to pump all kinds of liquids miles and miles without the use of normal pumps, which I thought was pretty impressive.
Yeah.
Whether he ever achieved that or not, I don't honestly know. But I do know that the purification aspects of water were looked into very carefully and developed to quite a high degree of perfection while he was living in China. He was the guest of the Chinese government and spent 7 years doing research at their expense in the Mongolian Metals Institute. And while he was there, is when he came up with this idea of using Brown's gas as a means to purify water particularly to desalinate water. And as a result, it has designs that the entire Chinese merchant marine, merchant marine division, along with the Chinese Navy, have now employed Brown's gas desalinization units on their ocean-going vessels. And what I find ironic is the fact that here we have an entire nation that saw the benefit of this technology, went ahead and applied it, and didn't mind pumping a few million bucks into its development. And here in this country, the professional attitude towards Brown's gas is that it doesn't exist, and if it did, it would be worthless anyway.
Yeah, so, well, that doesn't make as much money as they make with petroleum. That's why.
I suppose you're right.
Yeah.
That is a pretty sad state of affairs, though.
Mm-hmm. Not to interrupt your train of thought. I'm listening to this now. Did he ever propose to build an engine, let's say, for a car or some other kind of land vehicle that just ran on water? I know that others have done this, and I'm wondering if they've done it using this. I'm not necessarily talking about the steam engine per se, but something more efficient.
Well, when I was working with him in California, he had quite a huge Brown's gas generator there that was actually powered by three-phase electricity. And as I recall, it was supposed to produce 10,000 liters per hour of Brown's gas. Now, that's a lot. That's quite a lot of gas. And the purpose that he developed that thing for was he had a vehicle there. I forget what it was, but it was a foreign car. It might have been, what the heck is that other German vehicle that's made by Volkswagen? Carmen Ghia? Does that sound right?
Carmen Ghia? I don't know. I thought that was an Italian car, but maybe maybe I'm mistaken.
Well,
the name is...
Anyway, it was a European design vehicle, and I thought he said it was a Carmen Ghia, but anyway, whatever it was, the intention was to actually put it up on jacks, and so it wouldn't go anywhere, and then literally deliver the gas to the engine and run it in place and learn all he could about, using Brown's gas as a fuel. Mm-hmm. And he assured me that if everything went according to his plans, that the next thing he was going to do was to look for a way of creating huge amounts of Brown's gas on board the vehicle. And that's really what interested me. I had thought that if that was done in a traditional manner, it's going to require a large amount of electricity to power it, and since my interests are in that direction, I suggested to him that we collaborate in some respects and look for the possibility of using Tesla-type technology to provide power to create Brown's gas, which ultimately would be used as a fuel.
Well, if you added some device that worked on the principle of a dehumidifier, you could take the humidity right out of the air and convert it into water right there while the thing is running.
Well, I don't know how practical that would be in terms of his particular view of the subject, but I'm glad you brought that up because several years later, I think Brown had already passed away at that time. I was working with a gentleman in Texas. I would mention his name, but I don't think that would be a good idea because he's very ill now, if in fact he's still living. But anyway, I was working with this guy in a private laboratory, and he had come up with a device to do exactly what you're saying. It was constructed very much like an air conditioning unit, except for the fact that the heat exchangers were deliberately encouraged to cause condensation. And then he had a series of collector plates underneath the heat exchangers, which the water ran down on. And these things were arranged in such a way that all of these different plates tipped towards a central trough and delivered a lot of water to this trough, which then went through a little a pumping station of some sort and put the water in tanks. And, of course, the thing was powered electrically. And unfortunately, the amount of electricity required was very steep.
Mm-hmm.
But ignoring that for a moment, the idea is pretty amazing. And
thank you.
It worked.
No, I'm just kidding. Go ahead.
And it worked amazingly well. And there were machines of this character that were designed in different sizes. And the largest one that I witnessed while I was there, I believe, could produce something like 500 gallons a day, which is a fair amount of water.
Mm-hmm.
And it did it, you know, just by taking it out of the air. And his contention was that the units would work probably anywhere in the world, but their best and most economical outputs would be experienced in the southern temperate zones and the equatorial zones, because that's where the humidity was the highest in the air.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, this is really amazing stuff, because these aspects of water are things that most people don't even consider. They're so used to just turning a tap and not worrying about where all that stuff comes from.
Mm-hmm.
But now, with some of the drought conditions in the world and with the expanding of the deserts and all the other problems that we're facing, I think it would make a lot of sense to start seriously looking at these types of technologies and finding more economical ways of powering them than it does to build $27 billion atom smashers.
Now, did anyone, you know, this maybe this is a dumb question, but has anyone ever thought of capturing the exhaust of a water-powered vehicle, or, you know, Brown's gas vehicle, which is basically going to be pollution-free if you recycle that? Is there anything retrievable, or does that become an issue with the decomposition of the water molecule, you know, where you have maybe it's I'm almost answering my own question here, I guess. If you're dividing the H2O into HHO, then you're going to have something else coming out the exhaust. But I'm just wondering.
Yeah. Well, the exhaust that came out, as far as I knew, was actually pure water vapor, and
mm-hmm.
And I forget if it was and I think there was some oxygen that came out with it as well.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, the fact of the matter is that what came out was purer than what went in.
Well, then
it would make
sense then to recycle that back into the engine, and you wouldn't even be polluting anything then. You'd have like basically a closed circuit of the gas.
Well, except for the fact that you'd still have to have some energy to disassociate the stuff in the first place.
Yes.
And I was very interested in addressing that problem. But as usual, there was no money and no time, and now, of course, the guy is dead.
Mm-hmm.
But I think you're going to see a lot of new technologies emerging, Don, where the so-called restrictions of the accepted paradigm are eventually breached. Because for anybody that has the proper attitude, You don't really have to be too smart to realize that relative to the way we do things, the universe offers an almost infinite number of alternatives. And, you know, why should we not avail ourselves of them? You know, this little strange phenomenon of the HHO gas is only one tiny example. I mean, if I was to go to my files and start pulling out some of the things that I've either personally investigated or that I know have been investigated by other researchers, let's say since World War II, the number of things that have been attempted and investigated are literally staggering. And, you know, it's just amazing to me that the negative forces that control this planet have managed to keep such tight reins on everything to the point where, you know, only now, when their own systems are threatened with, you know, possible curtailment of profit, are they even thinking about looking at alternatives. And the ones that they're entertaining are all fuel-related anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So,
And before they even announce that they're looking at these things, they've already basically figured out how they're going to control it when it does get developed and comes out and is made available to the public, because they're interested in having the public foot the bill to their own personal coffers.
Always.
You know, it would be, and now, you know, one, this is sort of a funny thought that I had when I was thinking about using Brown's gas. You'd almost have to put some kind of filter as you're taking the humidity out of the air, converting it to water. We're talking about the dehumidifier, of course. And you'd have to put this filter on there so the car wouldn't get Morgellons disease from the chemtrails they're spraying in the air, because Morgellons grows fibers, and it'll clog up the fuel system. So it was just a crazy thought I had. Anyway,
I understand. I can see the humor in the analogy.
Yeah, the Morgellons isn't humorous, but just the thought. I mean, we've got so much pollution in the air. And it makes me wonder, you know, while you're describing all these things, I just got these flashes of consciousness going through me, wondering what impact all this has on water, what it does, if it reduces its intelligence or just makes it ineffective. In other words, it becomes, it loses its life force, in other words.
It definitely does that. There's no two ways about that. I mean, that's been investigated now by, oh my gosh, hundreds and hundreds of people. I mean, you know, for an entity which has been so widely looked at and has been researched to the point where its active principles are pretty well understood by independent researchers, it's amazing to me that they still insist on saying there is no life force. You know, you're just essentially a high school experiment gone wild. Mm-hmm. You know, that there's no, you're basically a biochemical engine and there's no finer force involved, you know. To me, that's utter rubbish, and it's amazing that they can keep that belief sustained for so long.
Yeah. Well, you know my interest in coming back to let's say potable water. You know my interest in healing with music, and I know that water can be incorporated into that. That water can be either purified or assist in the process of healing humans and animals and plants and living things. And I'm thinking of the all the properties of water, and I guess you've just debunked an article that I read a couple of months ago. In fact, I was outraged when I read this. if water responds to electromagnetic energy, which I'm certain it does, and I'm sure you are certain, then there's a principle there that can be applied to healing.
And, oh, absolutely.
Yes, and this article I read, it was some, I don't know what you would call them, a scientific pedagogue that was saying that the human body doesn't react to magnetic energy, and I thought that was absolutely ridiculous. This was someone from the pharmaceutical industry that was just trying to debunk all of the magnetic devices that are out there that people are claiming are healing them. Now, if we were to incorporate and understand water on that level and really do research and the proper amounts of sound or the proper amounts of light to add life force to the water, in other words, to purify water, for the purpose of drinking it, for the purpose of growing crops, we could begin to grow healthy crops again. We could begin to sustain our bodies and our minds and possibly open up our, not even possibly, definitely open up our metaphysical abilities. On a spiritual level, we would become more conscious. We would have to. And so, The reason for this tolerance of pollution and ignorance about the importance of water, you know, what's the point in getting pure water and putting it in a plastic bottle to consume the plastic molecules? You know, it doesn't make any sense. Yet they're perfectly fine with that because the petroleum industry's gotten its products into that arena too. And they don't care about polluting or murdering people, giving them a slow death because they're not willing to admit the shortcomings of the various types of containers that they've created. What is it, 7 types of plastics that are used to create bottles to transport and to sell and deliver liquids to the consumer?
Yeah, and the irony of it is that the most commonly used one is labeled with the miniature number 1, which you can look at the bottom of all of your drinking water containers and see the little number 1 stamp there. And that is the number, the lowest number on the grading of the bottle plastic is the one which leaches the most materials into the water,
mm-hmm.
Or into the content of the bottle, I should say. And so that's ironic to me because when was it? Last week we were talking about the mock estrogens and how they are affecting, human reproduction and
yes,
all these other attributes of.
We've actually got the hormone pills and what have you going back into the water supply as well. What do they call those? PETs or PETs or PETs, I think they call them. Polyethylene terephthalate, I think it's called. That's one of those fun words. If you can't say it, you shouldn't eat it. You know?
That's for sure.
The fact that this is permitted. I mean, somebody's making money, obviously, you know, you can assume that our lawmakers or legislators are owning stocks and all of this stuff, and they make a ton of money from this. But the dangers, when they say, well, this has a high risk of leaching or it's a lower risk of leaching is leaching. And there are other methods of delivering pure water. There are a variety of water machines that have come out that actually deal with the issues, not just of the purity of the water, but even making sure that the alkalinity or the acidity of the
pH.
Water is, yeah, well, of course, the pH of the water can be regulated, or the water can be taken out of the air. Now, all of these systems are dependent upon electricity, so if the grid goes down, you know, people have to have an alternative method of running these machines. But in the meantime, well, we do have the grid because they want to make their money. They're going to keep it going for a while. We could be using these types of machines instead of buying bottled water, which some of these companies are even admitting is nothing more than tap water. Tap water put into these plastic, these dangerous plastics. Now, what kind of chemical reactions are going on with tap water in these bottles? You've got chlorine and these fluorides in there. It's got to be just a death cocktail. What else can it be?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, some of these compounds, like, for instance, hydrogen fluoride, is an extremely poisonous gas, and, you know, the ingredients are there, actually. It's just a question of whether or not the circumstances are right to liberate it. And that brings us to another interesting thing, which I think I mentioned to you on another show, and that is that the temperature of water and its lack of motion or its dynamics, in other words,
mm-hmm.
are also something else which needs to be considered. Because as this global warming phenomenon, whether it be man-made or otherwise, begins to make its presence more and more felt on Earth, they have now started to see that there are new types of bacteria which are evolving, and they like to make their appearance in these isolated lakes and places of that sort when the temperature gets higher than it, you know, would be normally. And these things grow prolifically. I don't know anything about them per se, except that they manifest as a greenish-brown slime or scum that floats on the upper layers of the lake water. And the irony of it is that when these colonies reach a certain saturation point, they begin to produce large quantities of hydrogen sulfide gas. And the first sign of that is that you have a lake with apparently brown water in it, and it's surrounded by all dead vegetation. And some of the most recent investigations now are wondering if this isn't possibly one of the mechanisms that was responsible for mass extinctions. Because if it ever took place in the ocean, it would be bye-bye Charlie for a lot of species, probably us included.
Yeah. Well, Jim, we're running out of time here, I suppose we could go on with this topic on another show. The next time you're on, which will be a week from this coming Friday, I have a different guest actually coming up. You were kind enough to switch places with him accommodate him. Greg Evenson is going to come on and tell us some important things going on in our law enforcement agencies. But the following Friday, if I think it would be interesting to talk about your Dynaflux generator. I really do. I think it's time that we start looking at alternatives and solutions that can save people money. And believe it or not, I may have some interesting news to share with you off the air in that regard. So if you're up to speed on that, unless you want to continue this discussion of water, well, certainly we can do both in the same show. So,
sure.
Any closing thoughts that you'd like to make? I know there's a lot more that you wanted to cover. But in terms of what we've talked about tonight and what your heart tells you about all these topics.
Well, the one thing that I kind of contemplate a great deal nowadays is the view that alchemists had on water. and that is that it was a lot more than just a compound. It was a universal substance containing primal energies, and it changed in its own manifestation as you went higher and higher above the planet. And so, you know, we talk about water vapor being in the air, and then we talk about an ethereal water being present at the outermost regions of the atmosphere. And then, you know, it becomes even more refined after that. And according to them, it permeated all of space and ultimately was looked upon as the ocean in which the stars swim, was the way they used to like to describe it. And the only reason I bring that up is because even if there's a slight chance that that's true, it's so amazing, because that would mean that water was truly a universal thing. And now you've got all these scientists looking to show that there might be water on Mars, for instance, or water on the moon. But imagine if it turns out that the alchemists from 2,000-3,000 years ago were correct in their thinking, and it turns out that water in another form, possibly HHO for that matter, permeates all of space and it's one of the true universal creations that God has given us. I just think that's an amazing thought in itself. And even though nobody's going to give me $27 billion to investigate it, I certainly think it's worth thinking about.
Yes, well, we've seen pictures of Mars and the moon, and we've gotten the whited out, you know, pictures. You can go down to your local office supply store and buy a bottle of white out and try to mask these photos. But as many times as you and I have talked about all the anomalies seen on Mars, now they come out recently, within the past couple of weeks, scientists are excited they may have found water on Mars. Are they coming out with that? Because we've already spilled the beans, do you think? And they don't want us one-upping them? I mean, we haven't spent a penny on bringing that information to the listening audience. And they're spending billions and trillions of dollars to every 20 or 30 years let out one little morsel of information. Like we're too stupid to see it ourselves. Isn't it ironic?
Well, it's not only ironic, it's downright annoying, but, unfortunately, we have to live with it for a little while longer, Don.
Yeah, a while longer. Yes, and we'll go on living. And then we won't have to live with it. That's the beauty of it. I'm clarifying your definition a bit.
No, I got that. I understand what you mean.
Yes. Well, thank you so much for accommodating Friday night's guest, and I look forward to your next interview a week from Friday. You'll be on the show. And we can continue this water discussion, and I would like to go in a little bit and talk about your Dynaflux generator. I think it's time.
I'm happy to accommodate you, Don, and we'll see what we can put together.
Okay, very good. Well, let's say goodnight to the listening audience. Folks, you have been listening to Evident Footprints and our special guest, Jim Murray. Jim's got some really cool photographs on my website, directlightproductions.com. A dual synchronous capacitor that he developed for Bethlehem Steel a number of years ago. And we had some really great times talking about some of the anomalies that he's experienced in his days of power production. And we may come back and share some of those with you the next visit. Special thanks to Don Newsom for making Evident Footprints possible, and Seth Hendrick for finally getting us on the air tonight. And join us tomorrow night when my special guest will be Mr. Michael Anthony. In the meantime, everyone have a night filled with peace, love, and light, and have a good night.